Hello, I'm Rob, a producer on the Black Country Talking News, and this week's edition is for the 10th of February 2021.
Hello, and welcome to the Black Country Talking News, brought to you by Sightloss charity Beacon Centre. A message to our listeners who receive the Talking News on CD in the post. This remains in paper envelopes and not the usual plastic wallets, so there's still no need to send anything back to us. We're pleased to confirm that the Talking News is now available via Alexa. All you need to do is say, "Alexa, play Black Country Talking News." Our Talking News service is also available via the following methods. Calling 01902 213 210. Visiting our website, www.beaconvision.org/talking-news, as a podcast on the Black Country Radio website, www.blackcountryradio.co.uk/podcasts, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by simply searching Beacon Black Country Talking News and hitting the subscribe button, and on your mobile or tablet device by downloading the free British Wireless for the Blind Talking News application from your App Store. We hope you enjoy this week's edition.
Thank you, Simon. And reading this week, we have myself, Rob, writer Graham Fisher, Mina, Ed, Helen, Liz, Christine, Ian, Angela, and of course, Flashback Roger. In this week's edition, we have an update from Beacon, some local news from the Black Country, we have the Flashback Quiz with Mina, news from West Bromwich Albion and Wolves, a new Did You Know feature from Flashback Roger, a look at the UK's changing population figures, the weather, information about a new Beacon service to combat loneliness, and rounding all that off, an edition of Tales from the Barn by Graham Fisher. But we start with some local news, brought to us by Angela, Christine, and first up, it's Ian.
Police have handed out around £5,800 fines to people breaching lockdown rules since new penalties came into force. West Midlands police say the majority of the fines were given to people at house parties, while large gatherings at weddings have also been reported, as well as birthday parties. It came as concerns were raised over funerals taking place in parts of the region with up to 200 people. New powers enabling police to hand out fines of £800 to illegal gatherings of more than 15 people started last week. The penalties, which supersede the old fines of £200, doubles for each offence up to a total of £6,400. Speaking at the region's weekly coronavirus briefing, West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner David Jamieson said, "The main offenders have been people who have been holding house parties. We are also aware that some weddings have taken place which have flagrantly, I'm afraid, broken those COVID rules. The vast majority of people are compliant, but I would say to those who are not compliant that we have already had about 50 of the larger £800 fines that came in earlier this week. The police will take action if it's required against those people who are putting their own and other people's lives at risk." He added that a number of birthday parties had also broken the rules.
A well-loved television presenter has joined the increasing number of people who have received a COVID-19 vaccination. Nick Owen from BBC Midlands Today was given his first vaccination at the Black Country Living Museum in Dudley. He spoke about the significance of the vaccination and what he felt about it. He said, "One is always anxious about going to the doctor's surgery or going to have a jab, and this is sort of historic, isn't it really? So this feels really different." The 73-year-old joked that he would be considered a relic and an exhibit as he entered the museum and remarked on how impressed he was by the operation in place. He said, "I have to say, the organisation is astounding, and the scale of it, I had no idea there would be so many people about. They're doing 1,000 a day, 7 days a week, and that's just in one place. When you think of all the organisation they've had to do to get this sorted in the first place, it's amazing. The car park was very busy, which surprised me because I know everyone has an appointment and it's spaced out every 5 to 10 minutes. After receiving his jab, Mr. Owen said he felt fantastic and said that he had felt quite nervous beforehand, and also said that the national effort of it had a real resonance for him. He said, I feel absolutely thrilled that I've done it, and it's a really big moment. It's been a very scary time, and there didn't seem to be a light at the end of the tunnel, but there clearly is now, so I'm incredibly grateful and relieved that I've had it done now. I also don't feel any after effects, just a bit of stiffness in my left arm and nothing much else, so this is a great weight lifted off my shoulders.
Local elections are set to go ahead in the Black Country and Staffordshire, but voters will have to bring their own pencil under COVID-19 rules. The Cabinet Office confirmed COVID secure polls would be held as planned, despite fears the pandemic would lead to them being delayed again. It means elections for councils, along with mayoral and police and crime commissioner elections, will go ahead on May the 6th, dubbed Super Thursday. In the Black Country, voters will head to the polls to elect councillors to their local council, as well as electing the next police and crime commissioner. Elections will be going ahead for Wolverhampton Council, Sandwell Borough Council, Dudley Council and Walsall Council, and also Wyre Forest District Council. Current PCC David Jamieson is set to stand down, with Labour's Simon Foster, Conservative Jay Singh Sahal, Lib Dem John Hunt and Independent Julie Hambleton in the running. Meanwhile, voters will also elect the next West Midlands Mayor, with current Conservative Mayor Andy Street up against Labour's Birmingham Hodge Hill MP Liam Byrne. Other candidates include two-time Liberal Democrat parliamentary candidate Jenny Wilkinson and the Green Party's Solihull Borough Council Group Leader, Councillor Steve Caldwell. Under new voting rules, due to COVID-19, voters will have to wear face coverings inside polling stations and will be asked to bring their own pen or pencil to mark their ballot. And proxy voting rules will be changed so that people who have to self-isolate can request an emergency proxy vote up to 5 p.m. on polling day. The scale of Super Thursday means that every voter in Great Britain will be able to take part in at least one type of poll, making it the biggest event of its kind outside a general election.
Council tax in Dudley is to go up by the maximum allowed by the government from April. Households will pay 4.99% more, the limit which can be charged without a referendum needed to approve a rise. Council chiefs say it will mean an extra £1 a week for the average home, but residents will still pay some of the lowest rates in the country. Councillor Steve Clark, Cabinet Member for Finance, putting forward the budget, said, "This has been a year like no other, and we know there are still difficult times ahead. COVID continues to impact our lives in ways we could never have imagined and brought unprecedented challenges to our public services. We continue to support businesses, communities and residents through this crisis, and, with the help of government funding, have been providing unparalleled levels of financial assistance to those who need it." He added, "We never take a decision to increase council tax lightly. However, with levels in Dudley, some of the lowest in the country and the lowest in the Black Country, increases are difficult to avoid if we want to continue to provide services people will be proud of." The Treasury has told local authorities they can increase council tax by 1.9% and charge an extra 2.9% for adult social care. A property in Band D will pay an additional £68.91. On top of this, will be added extra charges set by the police and fire services, but which are collected by the local authority. The new proposed tax bands are A, £967.01, B, £1,128.18, C, £1,289.35, D, £1,450.51, E, £1,772.85, F, £2,095.19, G, £2,417.52, and H, £2,901.03. The budget will be discussed at the Council's Cabinet on Thursday, February the 11th.
Schools and parents will have 2 weeks' notice before they reopen, a Wolverhampton councillor has said. Councillor Dr Michael Hardacre, Wolverhampton's Council Cabinet Member for Education and Skills, said, "While there are too many unknowns to say at this stage that schools will definitely welcome back more pupils from March the 8th, we do at least have some clarity about the government's position. Importantly, we have been assured that schools, parents and carers will be given at least 2 weeks' notice of schools reopening to more pupils, which will enable them to prepare for return to face-to-face education. The Department for Education has also confirmed that schools will close to all children over February half-term. They will reopen to vulnerable children and the children of critical workers from the 22nd of February, and all other pupils will continue to receive high-quality remote education at home. We will continue to do all we can to support our schools, parents and carers, and we hope it won't be too much longer until all our pupils are able to return to their classrooms."
Three more local news bulletins coming up, but now it's time for our weekly update from Beacon.
Hi everyone, it's Helen from the Beacon Centre. I hope you're well and keeping okay despite the cold weather at the moment. On a walk with my family this weekend, we spotted some snowdrops. Honestly, I don't think I've ever been so excited to see the first signs of spring. Hopefully, it will mean better days ahead for us all. Of course, there's 2 days of note to get out the way in February 1st, Valentine's Day and Pancake Day, the latter being one of my absolute favourite foods to eat. We've marked both in our virtual activities taking place this week, but don't worry if you've missed them. There's something on every day between Monday and Friday with our lifestyle team. All our sessions are free to join and are available to anyone with sight loss or an associated condition. So whether you want to try some new exercise or you just want a chat, come along. We'd love for you to join us. You can find out more details, including how to join, on our Facebook page by searching for Beacon Centre, or alternatively, email Kim Williams at kwilliams@beaconvision.org. That's kwilliams@beaconvision.org. Talking about Valentine's Day, our Fab Lab created a range of amazing personalised gifts for Valentine's Day. The last date for ordering is February the 11th. But if you've got a birthday coming up, or if you just want to let someone know you're thinking about them during lockdown, then why not send them a personalised gift created for them by our Fab Lab team? Proceeds support people with sight loss as well, so it really is a gift that keeps on giving. Email fablab@beaconvision.org to find out about what we can do. Now, if you're looking for work or you just want to improve your skills, you don't have to put things on hold until the end of lockdown. We've a range of programmes which could be the support you need. But if you live in Cannock, Lichfield, Tamworth or Burton, our BBO Evolve programme can support you. Email evolve@beaconvision.org or call 01902 880111. The Building Better Opportunities Evolve project is funded by the European Social Fund and the National Lottery Community Fund. That's it for this week. This Valentine's Day, we're sending our love to all of our members. And remember, if you want to talk, get in touch to see if we can support you. You can call 01902 880 111 between Mondays and Fridays.
Thanks, Helen. Now we're back to the local news. Reading for us, we have Ian, Christine, Angela, and at the top of the bill, it's Ed.
A Black Country teenager has become the youngest person in the country to beat coronavirus and donate convalescent plasma for research. Alfie Watts was aged just 17 and 1 month old when he donated antibody-rich plasma. He became the youngest donor of the 25,462 people who have donated at least once. The sixth former from near Stourbridge is due to donate for the second time this month. The plasma from people who've had coronavirus contains antibodies which might help to stop the virus spreading in other people. Generally, people of middle age and older are worse affected by the virus and produce a higher antibody levels needed for donation, making Alfie an unusual contributor. He is one of only 59 people aged 17 who have donated so far. Alfie, who wants to become an engineer, had COVID in November, suffering mild symptoms such as loss of taste and smell. He said, "I went to sleep one night and when I woke up, I couldn't taste or smell anything. I was like, I'm pretty sure that that's going to be COVID. I've got no idea how I got it. I didn't have any other symptoms. It lasted about 2 weeks. My parents said they had seen something about plasma donation and I thought I could help out. My antibodies could help other people who are more ill. Convalescent plasma is being studied as a potential COVID treatment. The interim reports of plasma trials in hospitalised patients reported no overall benefit, though analysis for specific patient groups is ongoing. However, a trial found early use of plasma in people at high risk within 72 hours of symptom onset stopped the progression to severe disease in 50% of people. People classed as being high risk may have weaker immune systems and may not respond to vaccines. Donations are being taken while a further trial for these groups is being explored.
Highways bosses are to spend £1 million on a pothole purge and resurfacing residential roads across the Dudley Borough. The cash has been injected into the authority's budget in a bid to improve the borough's highways. It will target hundreds of potholes across miles of residential streets, as well as some complete resurfacing of roads in Dudley. Dudley Council leader Patrick Harley said, "We need a real purge on potholes across the borough, which is why I have decided to add £1 million to the budget. When we started setting the budget last year, we were very clear about investing in areas that are important to people. This is a massive investment to add to the commitments we have already made, and I am sure will be welcomed by everyone using the roads." The plans will be discussed at a meeting of Dudley Council's Cabinet on February the 11th. People can report potholes via the council's website at www.dudley.gov.uk.
Controversial plans for 600 new homes on Greenbelt land in Wolverhampton have provoked opposition from thousands of residents. Housing giant Barratt Homes has outlined proposals to develop a massive housing estate on the Penwood site in Blakenhall, prompting a 6,500-strong public petition and a city councillor's promise to resign if the move goes ahead. The land identified is located between the rear of the Ramada Park Hall Hotel and Colton Hills Community School, both in Goldthorne Park, and stretches all the way down to Penn Common. Councillor Paul Birch said a development of this scale would be catastrophic for Blakenhall and has pledged to quit his role as a councillor if the plans go ahead. 600 new homes is off the scale. We're talking about something that's the size of Womburn here, and no one wants it, he said. The west of Wolverhampton would come to a grinding halt. It would need a brand new primary school and a doubling in size of Colton Hills Community School, which already has 1,500 pupils. Considering this, the demand on health centres in the area and access to schools alone would be massive. With this type of housing project, the developers build the houses more or less on top of each other, with tiny little pockets of land in between, promising garden space. The pressure it would put on the Northway, Birmingham New Road and Sedgley would be immense. The Fighting Cocks would need a flyover. There's no way it would survive. The whole thing would be catastrophic, he added. We have submitted an official residence 6,500 name petition against the plans to the City Council, as well as an additional 2,500 handwritten signatures. I have said and maintain that if this plan goes through, then I will resign, said Councillor Birch.
Residents of a village have complained about having to travel to a neighbouring area to receive their coronavirus injections. Kimber resident Graham Goff, 81, said people who were registered at the village's only doctor's surgery were being sent to King's Winford Community Centre, 5 miles away. But he said the centre was being overwhelmed by the number of patients being sent there, meaning they were having to go elsewhere. Mr Goff, who lives in Holly Close, said the village had a large elderly population and many people did not have access to a car. Folk of Kimber are up in arms, he said. They're sending people to King's Winford Community Centre for their jabs, but they can't cope with the amount of people, so lots are having to go to the Black Country Museum. We have our own community centre in Kimber with a large car park, and in the past that's where we've had our flu jabs. But since Kimber has been taken over by Mossgrove King's Winford, all has changed. I know the NHS has a mammoth task in organising the jabs, and criticising is easy, but Mossgrove surgery has a tendency for second best for Kimber, and this has come out very strongly during this epidemic. Dr Simon Hughes, Clinical Director of the King's Winford Primary Care Network, said GP practices across the area were working together to provide a local vaccination service while continuing to maintain other services. From King's Minford Community Centre, we have safely vaccinated thousands of patients so far. We've been to local care homes and, for those patients who are housebound, to their own homes too, he said. We recognise that this service may mean patients travelling a couple of miles to receive their vaccination, but when you're asked to do so, we encourage you to say yes and come forward.
Fears have been raised that a council may have left it too late to protect a Willenhall park from more illegal traveller incursions. Wolverhampton Council confirmed security measures will finally be installed on their side of Coppice Farm, which crosses over the boundary and into Walsall in the spring. This follows Walsall Council's decision to install soil banks on its side of the area back in October, designed to stop vehicles getting onto the green space. But Willenhall North Councillor Adam Hicken said residents in the area are concerned Wolverhampton may have left it too late to stop issues the area experienced last year. In July last year, Coppice Farm was one of a number of sites across Walsall hit by unauthorised encampments. Around 15 vans drove onto the land from the Walsall side before eventually settling on the Wolverhampton part of the park. Councillor Hicken said, Walsall Council began work in the autumn to improve defences at Coppice Farm, with concerns being raised at the lack of planning from Wolverhampton Council to secure their land. Now residents are fearful that nothing will be done in time, giving vehicles the option of simply going around the new defences that Walsall has installed. We were hoping that Wolverhampton Council would have a joined-up approach to the protective measures that we've put in place in Walsall. But by the autumn, it was clear that nothing would be happening on their side of the border. A spokesman for Wolverhampton Council said, an order has been placed with contractors to carry out work to secure the Wolverhampton boundary of this open space from unauthorised usage. They will be installing timber posts, fencing, bollards and repairing chain link fencing. The work is due to take place in early spring and we thank residents for their patience and understanding during this challenging time.
We have two more news updates coming up, but now it's time to cross over to Mina.
Hello and welcome to the Flashback Quiz. All the answers you need can be found later in Flashback Rogers' new Did You Know feature. But for now, here are your questions. Are you ready? Question 1. What do you call a single strand of spaghetti? Question 2. What did McDonald's make broccoli taste of? Question 3. Where in the world is chewing gum banned? Question 4. What is unique about the novel titled Gadsby? Question 5. What colour is the blood of a lobster? And question 6. What was bubble wrap originally invented to be used for? As always, I'll be back to reveal the answers later in the show. But for now, good luck.
Thanks for those questions, Mina. Now we have some more local news, brought to us by Ed, Ian, Christine and Angela.
A campaign is being waged to halt speeding motorists through the installation of cameras along a road plagued by rogue drivers. Councillor Simon Phipps has called for average speed cameras to be installed along the Stourbridge Road at Hales Owen, which has a 30 mile per hour speed limit. He has spoken to West Midlands Police and taken the issue up with Dudley Council and fears that there could be a fatality unless something is done to slow down drivers. Councillor Phipps said, residents are concerned about the speed of vehicles along this stretch of road and particularly in the evening. We want to target drivers who are failing to pay attention to their speed through average speed cameras and more warnings and signs. This road is a main thoroughfare between Stourbridge and Hales Owen. West Midlands Police have said that if the council extends the existing cameras, they would carry out enforcement. There are cameras between Lye and Cradley, but local residents were disappointed when these were not installed along this stretch of roadway. It was only when the cameras were turned on that we realised they had been omitted from this area. We would like to see the cameras installed between the Lutley Oak pub and the Whitley pub, as there are no traffic lights between these and some vehicles reach speeds of 40 to 50 miles per hour. Dudley Metropolitan Council is looking into the request and the decision is expected to be made in the next few days.
Black Country developer Sandeep Bhatia of Lal Investments Property was given the go-ahead for the two-stroke-three-storey building on Wellington Road by Wolverhampton Council planners this week. The site has been left empty for a number of years, with only neighbouring properties using it for occasional parking. Councillor Beverly Momenbade said, "I'm really pleased that this vacant land is now being utilised and will create new homes in my ward for people. Hundreds of new houses have been built in Ettingshaw over the last few years to help meet the growing demand for homes, and I welcome this addition close to Bilston Town Centre. There's nothing worse than empty land laying unused and dormant. It attracts fly tipping and a host of other problems, so I'm very pleased work is due to start soon on this development to bring even more homes to the area." Agents Thorn Architecture said the new building would be a combination of two and three stories to fit in with the size and appearance of the late Victorian properties on either side. The new apartment block has been designed to be set slightly back from the road, the company said in a statement. Although two-storey, the neighbouring properties have tall roofs and converted attics and enjoy the generous ceiling heights associated with pre-20th century housing. This development will continue the mixture of uses along the Wellington Road and introduce a modern building which will contribute to the surroundings.
A burglary at a Black Country church has left it unable to play recorded music at funerals after a computer tablet was stolen. West Midlands police have been reviewing CCTV footage following the incident at St Thomas's Church in Stourbridge. No historical items were taken from the church in the raid on Sunday, the 31st of January, at around 2:30 p.m. But the theft of the tablet means the church cannot control its PA system. Reverend Andrew Sillis, the vicar of St Thomas's, said it meant the church on Market Street could not amplify voices of played recorded music at funerals. He said, "The thief was very fortunate not to have been disturbed, because there are usually people in the church. Replacing the stolen item will cost us 10 times what it is worth to the thief. Local churches like ours are the local community. So when folks steal from a church, they are stealing from their community, their neighbours, their family."
Ministers have been urged to speed up the awarding of aerospace contracts to help struggling firms recover from the pandemic. Jane Stevenson MP said the aerospace sector had suffered particularly badly over the past year due to COVID, reducing international travel to minimal levels. She called on the government to support West Midlands firms, including Collins Aerospace and Moog, both in Wolverhampton, by awarding new contracts as quickly as possible. Ministers say the defence industry has maintained a steady drumbeat of orders during the pandemic, while £24 billion worth of contracts are on the horizon. Speaking in the Commons, Wolverhampton North East MP Ms Stevenson said, "So many industries have been hit hard by the pandemic, including aerospace and engineering companies in Wolverhampton North East. I'm delighted to hear about more and more procurement contracts. What steps is the government taking to start as many of those contracts as quickly as possible so that we can really help our industrial economic recovery?" Defence Minister Jeremy Quinn MP said, "Throughout the pandemic, we have made certain to maintain the drumbeat of existing orders so that they have continued. Through the interim payments scheme, we have helped to support defence companies with cash where that has been required. It is right that core defence decisions are taken on a holistic basis in the context of the integrated review. However, we have, where possible, advanced procurement in particular on improvements to the defence estate, where tens of millions of pounds of improvements are ongoing as we speak. Collins Aerospace, which has two bases in Wolverhampton, announced 255 redundancies last year. Bosses said the decision was down to significantly reduced demand for commercial aviation products due to the impact of COVID-19.
A council chief has hit out at mindless vandals who damaged trees in Hales Owen Park. The trees were snapped off and grass damaged in Olive Hill Park off Hope Street recently. It is hoped the saplings will be able to regrow despite the damage, but the local authority will look to replant them next year if not. Councillor Karen Shakespeare, Dudley Council's Cabinet Member for Environment, Highways and Street Services, has hit out at the few selfish people who damaged the park. She said the authority would consider any requests for CCTV to be installed at Olive Hill Park as part of the council's priorities and wider CCTV programme. She said, "This mindless vandalism, where a few selfish people take it upon themselves to spoil things for others in our green spaces, is totally unacceptable. While they have been damaged, we hope that the saplings will be able to regrow and put out shoots in the spring. If they do need to be replaced, we will look to replant them as part of the following year's tree management programme. The damage to the grass is thankfully only superficial and should grow out as the weather warms up. Requests for CCTV will need to be considered as part of council priorities and our wider CCTV implementation programme."
Coming up next, we have some information read by Christine about a new befriending service designed to combat loneliness.
Feeling vulnerable, lonely, or just need to talk? We're here for you. Call 01902 880 111. If you are feeling alone and in need of someone to talk to, we can help. The Beacon Centre and our partners Dudley Mind offer a free befriending service designed especially for older people who might be feeling lonely. You'll receive regular contact from one of our trained and DBS checked volunteers who will be matched with you based on common interests. They can offer friendship and support, someone to talk to and help you access services that may benefit you. While COVID-19 restrictions are in place, our service is telephone-based, but we can also offer home visits when it is safe to do so. Anyone who lives in Dudley Borough or is registered with a Dudley GP and is over the age of 65 can sign up to receive support. To find out more, or if you would like to become a volunteer caller, please email referrals@beaconvision.org or ring 01902 880 111 Mondays to Fridays.
Thanks for that, Christine. And as it happens, we now head back to Christine, who along with Ed, Angela and Ian, has for us our final local news for this week.
A Black Country hotel where legends of the entertainment world, including Laurel and Hardy, Bob Hope, Bing Crosby, George Formby and Tommy Cooper have stayed, has ceased trading after being sold. The Station Hotel in Castle Hill, Dudley, has been on the market for offers of more than £1.25 million. The sale, for an undisclosed price, was agreed and completed just before Christmas. Josh Aspland Robinson from commercial property agents Knight Frank said the 38-bedroom hotel had been on the market for a couple of months before the sale. Details of the buyer have not been revealed. The hotel, which dates back to 1898, had just opened a new tea room in March last year before it was forced to close by the coronavirus pandemic. The later hotel building from 1910 was demolished in 1936 when the current larger building on the junction with Trindle Road was built. It was used by entertainers appearing at the old Dudley Hippodrome, directly opposite in Castle Hill, with Laurel and Hardy staying there in 1947 on their theatre tour of the UK that featured in the 2018 film Stan and Ollie. The hotel, reputed to be one of Britain's most haunted hotels, has also been used for Dudley's ghost tours for many years. Ghost hunts started from there and visited sites like Dudley Castle. An episode of the Most Haunted TV series featuring the late medium Derek Acora and Yvette Fielding was also filmed at the station in 2003. It was said to be haunted by the ghost of a murdered maid. In recent years, the hotel had been used for regular psychic fairs, mediumship events, Peaky Blinders nights, vintage fairs and soul and Motown nights. Anyone with inquiries about outstanding bookings at the hotel has been asked to email sales@stationhoteldudley.co.uk.
A songwriter is hoping a major vocalist such as Michael Ball or a choir will step forward to record a tribute he has penned to the National Health Service. John Woolridge, aged 75 from Coseley, who started working life as an engineer and then spent 30 years as a probation officer, has been writing songs since 1982. He wrote a tribute to the armed forces who saw service in the Falklands, and the song Santa Send My Daddy Safely Home to Me was recorded by Katie Teich. Later, he wrote for King and Country to mark the centenary of the end of the First World War, which raised £450 for the charity Help for Heroes. He said, "Now I've adapted the wording and I'm hoping a choir, perhaps even one representing the NHS, will get in touch, and I've even tried to contact the singer Michael Ball. I do not want a penny from this and want whatever it makes to go to funds for the NHS." Married with two grown-up children and six grandchildren, John said, "If this takes off, I hope it makes a lot of money for the NHS, and if not, it will still be a tribute. The country owes a tremendous debt of gratitude to the NHS for their relentless courage and resilience in the face of such adversity. To quote Churchill, never in the history of medicine have so many owed so much to so few." John has the backing tracks and sheet music to his song, and anyone interested in taking up the chance to record the song is asked to call 07528 195 005.
A new collaboration has begun to help protect a large area of ancient land. The Save the Corbett Meadow Action Group and Stourbridge Community Land Trust are looking to work together to protect the Corbett Meadow and to see it managed for public benefit in the future. The meadow behind Corbett Outpatient Centre is part of the land gifted to the people of Stourbridge in 1892 by John Corbett for the building of a hospital with 14 acres never built on. The current owners, Dudley Group of Hospitals NHS Foundation Trust, which inherited the land, has placed it on a register of publicly owned land with potential for housing development. The action group has opposed development and is pressing for the land to be protected as a local green space in the Black Country Plan when it's published in the summer. The Trust had joined forces with the action group to look at how best they could closely collaborate to secure the future of the meadow. Helen Cook of the action group said, "Firstly, we have to see off the threat of new housing developments taking away the meadow forever. We also need to see its use positively for the benefit of the people of Stourbridge, just as John Corbett wished." Eddie Morton from Stourbridge Community Land Trust said, "The meadow can become a wonderful place for people and protect the abundance of existing wildlife. It can be a place where physical and mental health can be refreshed and restored in a 21st century version of Corbett's intentions. Together, we can make this happen."
From Professor Chris Gritty to a stalwart former gritting driver, the new names of lorries tackling ice and snow in Wolverhampton have been revealed. The Pun, referencing the chief medical officer, Professor Chris Whitty, is among the eight names chosen by more than 3,500 people. And a ninth lorry will be named after Malcolm Lewis, who helped to maintain the city's roads for 20 years whilst working as a gritter driver. Mr. Lewis, who led a maintenance team, retired from full work with the council in 2014, but returned on a casual basis each winter to help out. The popular great-grandfather died last October, aged 71, with his colleagues wanting to name one of the new gritting lorries in tribute to him. Councillor Steve Evans, Cabinet Member for City Environment, said, "Malcolm was a stalwart of our highways maintenance team, hugely popular, a larger-than-life character. He worked on Wolverhampton's roads for 2 decades, and even after he retired, he still wanted to come back each winter to do the gritting rather than put his feet up. It's a tough job. When you consider the drivers are on call from October through to April, they can be called out at any time of the day and night, over Christmas and New Year, and often in treacherous conditions. Malcolm didn't mind that. He loved being part of the team, and his colleagues loved him, which is why they wanted to name one of the new wagons after him as a tribute." The other 7 remaining gritting lorries include Terrara Grit, "Out of darkness cometh no ice," after Wolverhampton's motto, "Out of darkness cometh light," Noddy Calder, Gritters Awe, Gritmore Reens, Banks's Gritter, and Nuno More Ice, after the Wolves' manager Nuno Espirito Santo. So far this winter, Wolverhampton's team of gritters have been called out 52 times, gritting a grand total of 12,302 miles of road. That's the equivalent distance of halfway round the earth.
A caring member of staff at a Black Country care home is helping residents to keep boredom at bay during lockdown. Matthew Pound, activities coordinator at Barchester's Broadway Halls care home in Dudley, works to improve the well-being of residents with a variety of activities and events. Due to COVID-19, the activities on offer have had to be limited to protect vulnerable people and staff members. Matthew, who has worked at the home for 10 years, decided he did not want anyone to miss out on his activities and instead has created a booklet for all residents called The Boredom Buster. It contains a mixture of word searches, quizzes and interesting facts about the local area. As mental health and stimulation of the brain is of key importance, especially with increased levels of isolation, Matthew offered to share his Boredom Buster booklet. Matthew contacted Dudley Council's community development team within the public health and wellbeing sector, who support community groups and improve the quality of life of people in the borough. The team loved his idea and want to share it with the groups they work with. Matthew has now been asked to produce even more of the booklets on a monthly basis. Speaking about the success of his idea, he said, "I am more than happy to create the monthly booklet as our residents enjoy looking through this and completing it. I am really pleased to know it will be shared and be of benefit to other people too." Sedgley Townswomen's Guild members will be receiving a copy of the booklet in March, followed by the support network of Sedgley and the local coronavirus support group, who have also expressed an interest.
It's now time to tune into Flashback Roger, who has for us this week the first edition of a new feature.
Hello everyone, it's Roger here again, and as promised last week, here's a new feature of Your Talking News, and we'll call it our Did You Know Moments. Each week, I'll be digging out some interesting, fascinating, funny and sometimes weird facts from around the world for you to enjoy, and as ever, where you'll find the answers to the quiz questions that were set earlier. So, did you know that spaghetto, confetto and graffito are the singular forms of spaghetti, confetti and graffiti? Although it might sound a little strange, the word for an individual piece of spaghetti is spaghetto. And the same goes for a single piece of confetti, which is confetto, as well as a single piece of graffiti, which is graffetto. That's according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. And also that McDonald's once created a bubblegum-flavoured broccoli. McDonald's was always introducing new items for their loyal customers, and obviously some are more successful than others. But their bubblegum-flavoured broccoli, which was a fast food chain developed in 2014 as a tastier version for the leafy green for children, was a complete failure. McDonald's CEO Don Thompson admitted that kids were confused by the taste. And also that chewing gum is actually banned in Singapore. There are also laws against spitting and urinating anywhere but in a toilet, which you are then legally obliged to flush if it's a public washroom. And quite right too. And this is a good one. In 1939, the novel Gadsby, not Gatsby, Gadsby, is the longest book ever published that doesn't contain the letter E. Back in 1939, American author Ernest Vincent Wright published Gadsby. It's a 50,000 word novel that doesn't ever use the letter E once. And that's even more astounding when you consider that the letter E is the most commonly used letter in the English language. And would you believe that lobsters have clear blood? Most of us are well aware that lobster shells change colour when they're exposed to heat, like in a pot of boiling water, for example. But the sea creature's blood is also intriguing because lobster blood is initially clear and turns blue when it hits oxygen. And this one will surprise me because it's surprising that bubble wrap was originally invented as wallpaper. If you can't wait to pop every air-filled pocket the minute you pull a piece of bubble wrap out of the package, you can imagine how irresistible it would be if it were covering your walls. Engineer Al Fielding and Swiss inventor Marc Chavanes probably didn't consider that when in 1957 they invented bubble wrap while trying to create a textured wallpaper by sealing two shower curtains together to trap air bubbles. Well, there you go. If that first batch of strange facts hasn't amazed you, I'll be very surprised. There are loads and loads of them for this wonderful world of ours. I hope you found them as enjoyable hearing them as I did digging them up. But for now, this is Roger saying bye for now. Enjoy the quiz. Ta-ra!
Thanks, Roger. You dug out some really interesting facts there. I really look forward to hearing some more next week. However, now we turn to Mina with the weather.
The weather for this week ahead is going to be settled but remaining cold. Due to the time of year, low UV levels are expected all week. The sunrise and sunset times are 7:28 a.m. for the sunrise and 5:22 p.m. for the sunset. For Friday, 12th of February, we have light cloud and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 1 degree. On Saturday, 13th of February, we have sunny intervals and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 1 degree. From Valentine's Day on Sunday 14th of February through to Tuesday 16th of February, we have a light cloud and a moderate breeze with a maximum temperature of 3 degrees. And finally, on Wednesday 17th and Thursday 18th of February, we have sunny intervals and a gentle breeze with a maximum temperature of 5 degrees. So that's your forecast for the week. As always, enjoy the weather.
Thanks, Mina. Now with news from West Brom and Wolves, it's Ian.
Hello, I'm Ian, and here's your latest football news. Wolves' injury woes have worsened as winger Daniel Podence has confirmed he could be out for up to 6 weeks. The 25-year-old Portuguese took to Instagram on Saturday night to announce he has suffered an adductor injury. He joins Rayan Aïnouri, Romain Saïs, Fernando Marsal and long-term absentee Raúl Jiménez on the sidelines, while Johnny Castro Otto is now back involved in training after several months out. Nuno Espirito Santo suggested in his pre-Leicester press conference on Friday afternoon that Wolves' situation had got worse, and Podence posted, "Unfortunately, injuries are following me these times. Now in the adductor, I will recover very well and return at 150%. Always happy because I have more reasons to smile than cry. And supporting my team in the next 5 to 6 weeks, thank you for supporting me." Wolves put in a robust defensive display, but lacked a killer touch once more as they drew nil-all with Leicester at Molineux. A hard-fought and fairly entertaining affair, despite it being goalless, saw Nuno Espirito Santo's side look organised and balanced after the much-needed win over Arsenal. But they could have beaten Brendan Rodgers' high-flying high charges, with substitute Fabio Silva most notably spurning a big chance towards the end. The Foxes had their opportunities too. Jamie Vardy glancing ahead a narrowly wide, in what proved to be the fourth 0-0 in the last 6 meetings of the two teams. Wolves seemed to be getting back on track. This was a far more confident outing with a nice number of encouraging signs. Johnny Castro Otto's return to the 11 for the first half, before being taken off as planned before the game, brought about a more steady showing on the back foot. They passed the ball with greater speed and intent, and they threatened down both flanks throughout the 90 minutes, Adama Traore being almost unstoppable. The onus remains on brushing up in front of goal, though. Willian José had a quiet game before being replaced by Silva, who was denied one-on-one by Kasper Schmeichel. Yes, the keeper deserves credit for making the save, but Wolves' record signing should not have given him the chance. If they can sort that out sooner rather than later, Nuno's men should start to climb towards the top half, and hopefully have a brighter end to the term with the FA Cup clash against Southampton also coming up on Thursday. Boss Sam Allardyce has confirmed Ainsley Maitland-Niles joined Albion because he was given assurances he would play in his favourite position. The Baggies pulled off a transfer coup to land the England international on loan from Arsenal on transfer deadline day. Set to make his debut at Tottenham, had interest from a host of other clubs in the Premier League, but the 23-year-old, who often played at full-back or wing-back for Arsenal, is understood to see his future in midfield. And being promised game time there for Albion was key to his move to the Hawthorns. It's why he came to West Brom. We're playing him in the position he wants to play, and his most favourite position, Allardyce said. It's one of the reasons why he chose the Albion. He is a bright and bubbly young man. He will bring us some extra quality that I think we need. Albion's miserable season continued after they were comfortably beaten by Tottenham. Second-half goals from Harry Kane and Song Heung-min saw Spurs run out 2-0 winners on what was a comfortable afternoon for Jose Mourinho's side. The Baggies put in a committed display and defended well for long spells, but with Spurs dominating possession throughout, it felt inevitable they would get the goals they needed to secure victory. and so it proved when they netted a quick-fire double after the interval. Albion did have some moments, with striker Mbaye Diagne seeing two goals ruled out for offside, but there was no denying that overall Tottenham deserved the points. The result means Albion have now conceded 28 goals in 10 games under Allardyce. That is the joint most a team has conceded after a manager's first 10 games. Danny Wilson, who was in charge of Barnsley, Nigel Adkins, who was in charge of Southampton, and Slavisa Jokanovic, who was in charge of Fulham, share that unwanted record. West Brom next faced Manchester United at home this Sunday on Valentine's Day.
Cheers, Ian. We now go to Liz, who this week is looking over the UK's population figures.
From the Black Death to Maastricht, how the UK population has changed. In 1800, the Russian Empire was home to 35 million people. The United States, then a somewhat backward agrarian society, had a population of 5.3 million. Great Britain, as opposed to the wider British Empire, was home to 10.5 million inhabitants. Even British India, one of the largest nations in the world, had a population of just 40 million. New figures from the Office for National Statistics revealed that the UK population grew to a record 66.8 million last year, meaning that there are almost twice as many people crowded into this small island today as the vast expanse of Russia at the turn of the 19th century. The figures actually show a slowing of the growth rate. The UK population grew by 361,000 over the 12 months to the middle of last year, or 0.5%. This is the lowest rise for 15 years, but nevertheless shows a country with a population density that would never have been envisaged even a century ago. The earliest reliable record of Britain's population can be found in the Domesday Book of 1086, which found there were just over 1.7 million across the Norman-held counties of England and Mid Wales. Over the next century, the population saw rapid growth, rising by 81% to 3.1 million by 1190. The trend continued over the next 30 years, reaching 3.97 million by 1220. Of course, these early figures need to be treated with considerable caution, particularly given the fluid state of the boundaries between the different kingdoms at this time. But as a general rule, it seems that the population increased steadily to something like 7 million by the start of the 14th century, when the Great Famine marked the start of a series of events that would reverse that trend. The beginning of the 14th century was marked by a series of localised famines across Europe, with France among those badly hit. But England had managed to avoid them until unusually heavy rainfall came during the spring of 1315. The wet weather continued across most of Europe throughout the spring and summer, and temperatures also remained unseasonably cool. Grain did not ripen, leading to widespread crop failures, while straw and hay for animals could not be cured, creating a shortage of meat. There was also a shortage of salt needed to cure and preserve meat, and these factors all contributed to the doubling of food prices between spring and midsummer. Even King Edward II suffered when he stopped at St Albans on August 10, 1315. His entourage struggled to find bread, leaving him unable to eat. The weather returned to normal during the summer of 1317, but by then the damage had been done. The famine left people weakened by diseases, including pneumonia, bronchitis, and tuberculosis, and so much of the seed stock had been eaten that food supplies would not return to normal until 1325. The death toll of the Great Famine had been hotly debated, but it is likely that many towns and cities would have seen between 10 and 25% of their populations wiped out. But that was just the beginning. In June 1348, the Black Death, the first manifestation of a plague that would wipe out half of Europe and Asia, arrived on the British mainland. It is believed that the bubonic plague pandemic began in Mongolia in 1346, spreading westwards across Europe. The first recorded case on the British mainland was in Weymouth, when a sailor arrived from the then British province of Gascony. Within a year, it had spread across the whole country, and it continued to spread until the winter of 1349-50 largely killed it off. Estimates of the death toll vary wildly, with some putting the figure as high as 90% of the population. Realistically, the population of England at that time probably stood at around 6 million, and in the region of 30 to 40% would have been killed as a result of the illness. But while the first and worst outbreak was over in a couple of years, the plague didn't go away. Indeed, the next 300 years became known as the plague centuries, with sporadic outbreaks until the Great Plague of London in 1665 to 1666. From the Black Death to the mid-1500s, the population of England showed a slow decline, flatlining at about 3 million mark before starting to rise in the late 16th century. But it was the Industrial Revolution, beginning with the opening of the Iron Bridge in 1781, which saw a population explosion, largely sparked by an increase in life expectancy. While social historians often portray the 19th century as an era of the haves and have-nots, with the working classes living in grinding poverty and squalid housing, the reality is that this was a vast improvement compared to what went before. The first modern-day census of 1801 reported there were 10.5 million people living in the UK, but by 1901 this had grown to 37.8 million. This happened despite a sharp drop in the fertility rate. In 1800, the average woman would give birth to 4.97 children during her lifetime, falling to 3.58 by the end of the century. However, while the birth rate was falling, life expectancy grew considerably during the 19th century. In 1543, life expectancy stood at 33.9 in 1543, reaching 40 by 1803. But over the next 100 years, this would rise to 49.5, driving the growth in population. This trend continued throughout the 20th century, with life expectancy passing 50 in 1907 and reaching 60.8 by 1930. The First World War cost 886,000 British lives, but this was not enough to stop the inexorable growth in population, which had reached 41 million by the outbreak of the Second World War. By this time, the fertility rate had fallen to 1.84, but life expectancy had grown to 63.6. The return of servicemen at the end of the Second World War sparked a dramatic spike in the fertility rate, rising to 2.47 in 1946 and 2.69 at the following year, marking the beginning of the post-war baby boom. The number of births broke the million mark in 1947 for the first time since 1921, a feat which was repeated in 1964 when the fertility rate peaked at 2.95. The 20th century also saw great strides in medicine, which helped life expectancy grow to 71 by 1965. By 1972, the population had reached 56 million, a level at which it would plateau for more than a decade. But 1983 saw the number of migrants entering the UK exceed those leaving for the first time since 1964, a trend which, apart from a couple of blips, has continued ever since. The Maastricht Treaty of 1993 guaranteed freedom of movement for all member states in the newly formed European Union and saw net migration peak at 268,000 in 2004, taking the UK population to almost 60 million. Positive net migration has continued ever since, although it did fall back a little to 177,000 in 2012, before rising again to 332,000 in 2015.
Thanks for that, Liz. It's now time to find out how many questions you got right in our flashback quiz. So, Mina, do you have the answers all lined up for us?
I have. Here are your answers for this week's flashback quiz. Are you ready? Question 1. What do you call a single strand of spaghetti? The answer, spaghetto. Question 2. What did McDonald's make broccoli taste of? And the answer here is bubblegum. Question 3. Where in the world is chewing gum banned? And it is banned in Singapore. Question 4. What is unique about the novel titled Gatsby? And the answer, it doesn't use the letter E at all. Question 5. What colour is the blood of a lobster? And the answer here, of course, is clear. And finally, question 6. What was bubble wrap originally invented to be used for? And the answer is wallpaper. How did you do? I hope you all did very well. But if not, there's always another chance to have a go next week. Now, to end this week's edition of the Black Country Talking News, we head to the barn for a tale from Graham Fisher.
Hello. I have been a devotee of two-wheel transport for as long as my memory serves, and by the age of 3 was quite adept on my little pushbike. As I grew older, I took to the powered variation and enjoyed the wind in my face, minus the requirement to pump my legs up and down. Lo, did I fall in love with motorcycles. Thus far, I have never set foot or wheel on the Isle of Man. But when I am challenged condescendingly by my fellows with, "Call yourself a biker and never been to the TT races," I reply with an air of not entirely mock superiority. "Nope, for I've ridden Harley Davidsons around the States and Canada. Does that count?" That usually stymies any further disparagement of my credentials and inevitably reminds me of the occasion when I was in the USA doing precisely that. It was some years ago now. But will I ever forget the spectacle, the welcome, the sound of ZZ Top at who knows how many decibels, and the hundreds of thousands of aficionados who had gathered from around the world with the single purpose of celebrating the birthday of what was for them, and me, one of the greatest motorcycle marks in history? Ah, yes, as Monsieur Chevalier famously sang, I remember it well. Fabulous. But one curious aspect about the USA that left his particular impression is their utter devotion to the American flag. It's something that every first visitor to the USA immediately notices. Everywhere, just everywhere, indoors and out, flies an American flag. It's part of the American fabric, if you'll excuse the pun. It unites in celebration and joy. It comforts in crisis and hurt. It is emblematic of the very spirit of the people. And it is treated with such reverence. Until recent times, been subject to a very strict code of etiquette that included only being flown between the hours of sunrise and sunset, never in darkness unless lit, and even then only on special occasions. It must be raised briskly, lowered ceremoniously, and never touch the ground. The shock of students disavowing this veneration by burning the flag during the Vietnam War led to a sense of national outrage. Yet even though Pandora's box was opened, the stars and stripes still defines America. And so, though it has not yet generated quite the same degree of general fervour, and admittedly in a different milieu that I don't believe will blur my point, the more recent incarnation of our very own Black Country flag has already helped further promulgate the notion of Black Countryness. This is surely no bad thing. Indeed, I proudly confess to the one that flies privately in my workshop, and which comforts me greatly that in this rugged Celtic borderland there lies a small haven in which I can feel at one with my roots, whilst far from them. We can trace the origins of the Black Country flag to April 2012, when the Black Country Living Museum launched a competition encouraging local residents to develop a flag to celebrate the Diamond Jubilee of Elizabeth II and the hosting of the Olympic Games. The flag was subsequently a catalyst for the annual Black Country Day and Festival, an excellent start. Yet there is much, much more to this flag than simply offering a tangible totem that identifies the Black Country. And herein lies the crux. Where exactly is the Black Country that the flag is intended to denote? And where does the name originate? And indeed, why are either particularly important? The where is it part is easily, though imprecisely, explained. And I well recall a broadcast I once undertook with three very distinguished guests, during which I swear I received four definitions. Just ask anyone within shouting distance of Dudley Castle, and an opinion will be forthcoming. As for why our identity is so important, well, although the recognition of our flag, and since 2009 the inclusion of the Black Country on the Ordnance Survey map of the area, are huge steps in our defence, there is no room for complacency. Previous threats to the area being anonymised, possibly even lost as an entity, are amply documented. Well, that may well be my theme for another day. But the taxonomy of Black Country, the name our flag represents, why? How come? Well, there are a number of suggestions. Some exude more gravitas than others, which in turn may appeal by their whimsy. Allow me to provide just one example of each. In the 1860s, Elihu Burritt was American consul in Birmingham, and his duties included reporting back to his taskmasters on the productive capacities, industrial character, and natural resources of the area. He accrued his information by means of a series of walks around the region, which he published as a book. Written in a style that now seems florid and winsome, his Walks in the Black Country and his Green Borderland, first published in 1868, nevertheless still paints a lurid contemporary picture. The very first lines of the opening chapter set the scene. The Black Country, black by day and red by night, cannot be matched for vast and varied production by any other space of equal radius on the globe. It is a section of titanic industry, kept in murky perspiration by a set of tubal canes and vulcans, week in, week out, and often 7 days to the week. Gosh. The Black Country flag, with its red, white and black background and motif of chain links and glass cone, is based on Burritt's graphic allusions. Although there are historical references to the region that offer inferences, the term may have existed well before the Industrial Revolution, with outcrops of coal scarring the landscape, for example, Burritt's work is one of the earliest that actually articulates the Black Country in writing, and thus we can be assured that the area was in fact already known as such by the mid-19th century. Yet there is another explanation that predates Burritt by several decades, and which, though not as precise in its assertion, is nonetheless a charming narrative, and one that, coincidentally, has its roots not far from my borderland home. In 1832, a young lady was on her way to Powis Castle as part of an educational tour around the country, when she was given a diary by her mother so she could record her experiences. The exercise became a habit, and the young girl continued to maintain a diary, written in black ink, right up to her death in 1901. Her early entries, during which time she was perhaps at her most youthfully impressionable, reveal thoughts of her visit to the dark region, when, in the year she received her first diary, she noted, "The men, women, children, country and houses are all black. But I cannot by any description give an idea of its strange and extraordinary appearance. The country is very desolate everywhere. There are coals about, and the grass is quite blasted and black. I just now see an extraordinary building flaming with fire." But there were heartening glimpses of this young lady's humanity, as she comments on a trait of which Black Country folk are still justifiably proud. "We have changed horses at Wolverhampton, a large and dirty town, but we were received with great friendliness." Revisiting the area 20 years later, she recorded, "One sees nothing but chimneys, flaming furnaces, and wretched cottages. you have but a faint impression of the life of which a third of a million of my poor subjects are forced to lead. It makes me sad. The mother in this charming tale was the Duchess of Kent, and her young daughter went on to define an English era. Her name? Well, it was, of course, Victoria. Enjoy your Black Country, and do join me again soon for more Tales from the Barn.
So that's it for another edition of the Black Country Talking News. A reminder to our CD listeners who have received CDs in padded envelopes that you don't need to send anything back to us. If you have a sight loss tip or someone you would like to wish a happy birthday to, just say hello to. Maybe even a poem or talking book you would like reviewed, then please get in touch with us at the Beacon Centre. Call 01902 880111. Email bctn@beaconvision.org or write to us at the Black Country Talking News, Beacon, Wolverhampton Road East, Wolverhampton, WV4 6AZ. We look forward to hearing from you. Thank you for listening, and thank you to all our supporters, donators and volunteers who without their support we would be unable to run this free service. Please note the information and views expressed in this recording does not necessarily represent the views of Beacon or Talking News and were accurate at the time of recording. Mentions of goods and services does not imply endorsement, and whilst every care is taken to supply accurate information, Beacon and Talking News do not undertake liability for any errors. So it's goodbye from all of us, stay safe, have a good week, and we look forward to bringing you next week's edition of the Black Country Talking News. Ta-ra!